Greetings, greetings, once again, to all my enemies and all my friends. Well, you may have heard the news, but stand by now for the worldview. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview, and I'm your host, Doug McBurney. It's good to be back. It's good to have you back. Welcome back to the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do help focus you on the events of the week through the ever-present lens of original thought. And I'm so glad to be back in Colorado. I was back east. Maybe I'll talk about that later. I was back east in the city, and well, let me just say it's nice to have some space. I walked out of a building at 5 o'clock in Manhattan, and I had a hard time getting to the subway without bumping into people. And that's really depressing. So I ducked into a cafe and bought a bottle of water and a ham sandwich for like $25. And I sat out the crush for just a little while. The sandwich was tasteless. The water was good. It's Italian bubbly sparkling water. I didn't know it was sparkling. Normally, I'm not a sparkling water guy. But just to get from the cafe to the subway station was like it was like a game of Frogger on the street trying to get through all the people. I don't know how people live that way. But if it wasn't for the people on the trip were the best part. A lot of fun, a lot of good folks. But just the crush and the press and the subway and the smell and the whole thing, I don't know if I could do it. But I don't want to bore you with my personal life. Let's start out with some important news, some good news, as a matter of fact. And we don't get a lot of good news. And this is good news, at least for the moment. It's from the Personhood File, where Breitbart reports that a Paris appeals court last week ordered the resumption of basic care for Vincent Lambert, the 42-year-old quadriplegic who French officials had ordered his nutrition and hydration to be discontinued. That means they ordered that he stop being fed and he stop being given water until he dies. That was the order of the French court. It was being carried out by a French hospital. But a new court ordered authorities to keep Vincent alive pending a review, by the Uncommittee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. So now the United Nations, the final decision will lie with the United Nations on when the French governing officials kill Vincent Lambert. And they will kill him. The die has been cast here. It's been cast before. And here in America, if you remember back in 2005 with Terry Schiavo. So every judge and every lawyer abandoned Terry Schiavo and allowed her ex-husband to kill her, along with the governor of Florida and the judiciary of the state of Florida. They all killed her. And so while this is a respite, Mr. Lambert had been deprived of food and water for almost 2 days before the court ordered that he be fed again. And Breitbart reports that Vincent Lambert is not terminally ill, a fact that is stressed by ethicists arguing on his behalf. He breathes independently, his heartbeat is spontaneous, and his internal organs function normally, meaning he is alive, meaning he is a person, and a person has the right to life. And just because a person can't feed himself or get a glass of water, it doesn't mean that his family shouldn't be allowed to help him by giving him food and water. And by the way, his mother and father, Vincent's parents, have vigorously objected to plans to euthanize their son. They've sought to transfer him to another facility to receive care. But Vincent's wife has pushed to have ordinary care removed. Ordinary care meaning feeding and water. His wife. Now, wouldn't the parents trump the wife? Well, as long as the parents want him to live and the wife wants him to die, wouldn't that? Of course, I argued that in the Terry Schiavo case right up until they killed her. Breitbart reports that the French mainstream media, for the most part, have taken the part of the French state in painting the picture of Vincent Lambert as a man who ought to die. In fact, the French press agency referred to Vincent as, quote, a vegetative Frenchman, unquote. And they call his situation a right to die case. They should call it a right to kill case because they're trying to give the state, the hospital, and Vincent Lambert's wife the right to kill him over the objections of his family members who are willing to take care of him. It just seems bizarre to me that if someone is willing to take care of someone and spend the money and do whatever it takes to take, whose business is it to anyone else? I'm assuming that his wife wants to remarry, and for whatever reason she doesn't want a divorce. I don't understand her motivation in the case. But it will all come out. And we will keep an eye on the Uncommittee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, and we will report back to you when they order Vincent Lambert to be killed, as they will. And that's one prediction I hope I am wrong about, by the way. And speaking of being wrong, I have to make a correction to a story from last week. In fact, I not only have to make a correction, I have to issue an apology. I have to issue an apology to the family of Marlon Ochoa Lopez, the young pregnant teenager who was murdered. You remember the story from last week. She was murdered and her baby was cut from her womb and taken by a pair of evil, evil women. And I was under the impression that she was unmarried because she was reported in the story as a pregnant teen. And the story never mentioned that she had a husband. And so when I returned from my trip, my extremely attractive audio engineer brought to my attention that she had seen a picture. And the picture said that the husband of Marlon Ochoa Lopez was holding his son. And so I started to do some research, and I found the latest story on the Ochoa Lopez murder and the state of the child. The child remains in, according to the hospital officials, remains brain dead. The family insists the child is getting better. They're hoping against all hope, and they don't want to unhook the child from life support. And they're devastated. And so I apologize for the incorrect inference that I made or that I drew. Let's see, inference or I was at my public school is showing. Anyway, I implied that she was unmarried because there was nothing in any of the reportage about her having a husband. And in fact, I read this latest article, and it's from the Chicago Tribune. And it's dated May 22nd. And they mention in the story, they say, Arnulfo Ochoa played the ultrasound recording of the baby outside Advocate Christ Medical Center, where the boy's been on life support since he was cut from 19-year-old Marlon Ochoa's womb. Doctors say the boy is brain dead. Let's see, the story goes on. This is the gift Marlene left me, said Arnulfo Ochoa. Arnulfo.
Doesn't say husband.
No, that's not her husband. That's her brother.
Oh, that's a brother.
But he says, my faith in God is keeping me going. He was surrounded by the teen's grandparents. It goes on to talk about the grandparents. They named the grandmother Custodia Castro Rodriguez. They mention Raquel Uristegui. That's the young murder victim's mother. They mention her in the article. They mention the grandmother, Benigna Perez. Anyway, you read the whole article. The article mentions her two brothers, her mother, her grandmother, but they never mention the husband. But in the middle of the story, there's a picture of Giovanni Lopez. Giovanni Lopez, who's not mentioned in any other reportage, but there's a picture of him holding the baby, obviously after this whole awful tragedy. But anyway, I apologize to the family. My only defense is that the official position of the mainstream media to never mention fathers ever led to my confusion and my unfortunate assumption. And so I apologize to the family, and I wish God's blessings on them. And I I hope the child recovers, and whether the child recovers or not, keep in mind that you will see the child again. You'll see the child again on Judgment Day, where he will hug his mother and his father and his grandparents, and then he will ask, "Where are those women who killed me?" And then he will rain judgment and wrath down upon their heads. Yes, so we will see the child again one way or another. So there is my correction. And after that, I really want some good news. We already had some good news with the respite for Vincent Lambert. That's certainly good news. But we have some additional good news from the Justice File. CNN is reporting. CNN, yes, brings us some good news. By accident, they stumble backwards into actual news once in a while. When they report facts, which they do once in a while. CNN reports that convicted serial killer and rapist Bobby Joe Long was executed last Thursday in Florida as two of his surviving victims looked on. One of his victims, Lisa McVeigh Noland, was kidnapped in November 1984 as she was riding her bicycle home from work at the age of 17. And Bobby Joe Long raped and held her hostage for more than 26 hours before he let her go. 1984, I said, yes. He was convicted of in the killings of 8 women in the Tampa Bay area. He was convicted in 1984, which is a long, long time ago. Let's see. Let's do the math, kids. 84, 94, 04, 14. 35 years. This man's been on death row for 35 years. He was sentenced to death in 1984, and he was executed last week after 35 years. Another survivor who attended the execution, Linda Nuttall, said there was no describing how this moment would feel. Her and her husband had placed a classified newspaper ad in 1984 to sell some furniture, but Bobby Joe Long showed up. And he raped Nuttall while her two young children were in the house. And Nuttall's husband, Kevin, says he got what he deserved. And I think we'll just leave it at that. He did get what he deserved, but he didn't get it quickly enough. I mean, how many of the witnesses in the case, were even still alive when he was put to death? How many of the people who were terrified in Tampa Bay when the killing spree was going on, how many of those even remember the story? Justice delayed is justice denied. But at least this one is not going to be getting out. Bobby Joe Long is in hell right now. And he is suffering because he was an evil murderer. And he will never get out. He'll never get out. But that's not the case for so many in our just system. Nine News in Denver reports. We get this from the Justice File. Nine News says that Eric Jensen was 17 years old when he helped his friend Nathan Ibanez kill Ibanez's mother, Julia, in June of 1998. And because he participated in a murder in our crazy upside-down justice system, he was sentenced to life. He dealt death, and he was sentenced to life, and he was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. That was in 1999, but now he's been resentenced. Now, they said no chance for parole. They said no possibility of parole. They said it wasn't even possible. Well, guess what? Because he was still alive, it was possible, and it is possible, and it is going to happen. He was resentenced after the U.S. Supreme Court's 2012 Miller versus Alabama case, which requires that state and federal governments consider the unique circumstances of each juvenile defendant in determining sentences. The ruling stems from research on adolescent brain development that confirms children's brains are less developed than those of adults, and punishments for crimes should be adjusted accordingly. Why? And how are you supposed to gauge? What? It's just insanity. John Hickenlooper, by the way, already granted a commuted sentence to Nathan Ibanez, who actually killed his own mother. And it makes him eligible for parole in 2020, which is next year, for crying out loud. Folks, without an ultimate penalty for murder, murder becomes an option for more and more people. And this is right in the face of justice, an insult in the face of justice. John Hickenlooper should be put on trial as an accessory to murder, right alongside these punks. Or maybe he should stand trial in place of Nathan Dunlap, the Chuck E. Cheese massacre. Remember that?
That's him too, huh?
Yeah, John Hickenlooper commuted his death sentence. John Hickenlooper should be put on trial as an accessory to murder. And when John Hickenlooper is convicted, he should duly be put to death by the governing officials of the state of Colorado, a state that he was not fit to lead, and a state that should ever repent of the idea that we elected such an evil, evil person. That's right. Get out of here, Johnny. Johnny Hickenlooper, you know where you're going. That's right. Get him out of here. Uh-huh. You see, folks, you see Eric Jensen and Nathan Ibanez, they very well may kill someone else. Now that they've gotten away with murder, having only spent some time behind bars, big deal. Now, Nathan Dunlap, his sentence was commuted, but John Hickenlooper was wise enough to commute his sentence to life in prison without the possibility of parole. So there's no chance, no possibility that Nathan Dunlap... You think it's possible that a judge somewhere might figure out some way to spring Nathan Dunlap upon the world again? Do you think it's possible? It is possible. It's absolutely possible. And, well, that's the state of justice. It's just disgusting. All right. And so if you let these people live, well, I think I've made my point. But here's another story that makes my point. Pulled this down from Fox News. This story sat astride the war file and the justice file. This is the intersection of the war file and the justice file. The story is a report about Allison Spann. Allison Spann. Do you remember that name, Allison Spann? You don't remember that name, but do you remember the name Michael Spann? Allison was just 9 years old when her father, Mike Spann, former Marine turned CIA paramilitary operative, became the first American to be killed in combat in Afghanistan. I remember the story. I remember many details of this story. You'll remember that in November 2001, American forces learned that Johnny Walker Black was among the Taliban fighters, an American from the Bay Area, John Walker Lind, who we dubbed Johnny Walker Black at the time of his trial. You'll remember that they discovered Lind in a prison, and he was being interrogated by Michael Spann. Well, what Johnny Walker Black did not tell Mr. Spann was that during his interrogation, he did not tell Mr. Spann that his fellow detainees were planning a violent uprising. The uprising indeed took place. And Michael Spann became the first casualty in the long war in Afghanistan that continues to this day. Well, Johnny Walker Black will be discharged. Oh, I'm sorry. He was discharged. Yeah, he's already out. He's out of prison. He was discharged on May 23rd. And if you remember, I don't know if you folks remember the story, but I'm going to refresh your memory. I remember all of this. So Johnny Walker Black was arrested as if he were a criminal. Now, he was discovered on the battlefield during a battle against a foreign army, the Taliban military. But for some reason, he was brought back to America and treated as if he were some sort of criminal. Now, I said at the time, and I stand by it, the prison uprising would not have occurred had the American forces killed every single Taliban and every single Al-Qaeda they found until they were all dead. That should have been the point of the entire war. Had that been the point, the war would be over. But the war is not over. And now, not only is the war not over, we have the ultimate insult against every family of every service member who lost that service member during this long war. Johnny Walker Black, out of prison. Initially, he was charged with murder, conspiracy, and the killing of Americans. He was charged with all these crimes. I remember I was mystified by why this guy wasn't put on trial in the field in a day or two, extract as much information from him as possible, and then kill him, and kill every one of them. That's the way I felt then, that's the way I felt now. Anyway, 9 of the 10 counts in the indictment, against a captured foreign soldier. Unbelievable. Anyway, 9 of the 10 counts were dropped, and Johnny Walker Black ended up pleading guilty to, listen to this, disobeying an executive order outlawing support to the Taliban, and for possessing a weapon in Afghanistan. Okay. That's what he ended up pleading to to our just a system. Anyway, he's out, and he's alleged to have told a TV reporter last March that he would continue to spread violent extremism and Islam upon his release. Now, Lynn's father, Francis, there's another detail I remember, is that when Johnny Walker Black was 12 or 13 years old, his parents split up because his father left his mother to go and be with a man. Because Johnny Walker Black's father was a flaming homo pervert and a lawyer to boot. And he left Johnny's mother to go be with a man, and Johnny's entire world crumbled around him and cracked and exploded, and Johnny ended up in a spider hole in Afghanistan covered in soot, trying to kill Americans. Well, Francis says he doesn't appreciate the terrorist characterization of his son. He says his son is a spiritual youngster who made a rash and blindly idealistic decision, but that decision was neither sinister nor traitorous in its intentions. Well, Mr. Francis Lind, the father, he made a rash decision to leave, to destroy his family and become a homosexual creep. And now the shock waves of that horrible decision are now rippling through our entire civilization as we discover that the American justice system, the American military, can't even figure out what to do with a terrorist who has a hand in actually killing Americans, further undermining any sense of justice that we might have been holding out hope for. Just because one guy decides to become a fag, and it just makes me sick. I'm going to move on from that. Anyway, I'm very offended that Johnny Walker Black is out of prison. And yeah, it could be. it could be that there are out there amongst our fellow Americans, there may be some marginalized right wingers who might be wanting to meet Johnny Walker Black. That could be an ugly situation. There could be a vendetta. There could be vigilante action against Mr. Johnny Walker Black that would further undermine any sense of justice in the country. It's just, that's not going to end well no matter how it ends. Unless Mr. Black repents, which is highly unlikely as he is a devoted Muslim convert at this point, hardened after nearly 20 years in prison. Not going to end well. Meanwhile, from the justice file, we find Josue Rafael Fuentes Ponce, a 16-year-old boy, and Joel Ernesto Escobar, 17-year-old teenager, have been charged with first-degree murder along with 14-year-old Cynthia Hernandez Nucamende in the death of 14-year-old Ariana Funes Diaz in Prince George's County, Maryland. Is it just me, or do that string of names not fit in Prince George's County, Maryland? That just doesn't fit, right? Well, the reason it doesn't fit is because they're illegal alien MS-13 gang members. The three murderers are. The 14-year-old Ariana Funes Diaz, well, I don't know much about her, but she has been murdered, and they have been charged. Last year, now here's the kicker. This will make you want to, I don't know, self-deport or march down to the Capitol there in Prince George's County with a pitchfork and a torch, at least rhetorically. Because last year, Fuentes Ponce and Escobar, the two accused murderers, were released from custody by Prince George's County after being charged with attempted first-degree murder, attempted second-degree murder, gang activity, conspiracy to commit murder, and attempted robbery. Why were they released? Who can even comprehend why they were released? I mean, can't we all agree that people accused of attempted murder should never be released before their trial? Never. How does that happen? Attempted murder? But they were released. And at the time they were released, Immigrations and Custom Enforcement had requested Prince George's County to tell them when and where they were released so that the gang members would not be released back into the community. ICE wanted them to be turned over to them so that they could be deported. But Prince George's County is a sanctuary city, and they released illegal alien MS-13 gang members accused of attempted murder. They just released them out on the street. They didn't tell ICE where they were. So ICE was unable to capture them and deport them, which I disagree with, frankly. I mean, why would we want to deport someone if they were convicted of murder? Wouldn't we want to try them and execute them? And then we could call their families and they could make arrangements for their bodies. That's what should happen. But that's not what happened. And now we have a 14-year-old murder victim, another family destroyed by the epidemic of bloodshed and murder that engulfs the nation every evening, every day, wave after wave of bloodshed and violence and murder, encouraged by the entire county government that was involved in releasing these two murderers. They've encouraged the epidemic of bloodshed and murder, and I think that every county government official involved in releasing these two murderers should go on trial right alongside them. They should be tattooed on their faces with MS-13 upon due conviction before they are all executed. They should all be put to death. But that's not what's going to happen. All right, the tattoo part, maybe I could be talked out of that. But the entire governing, it's just unbelievable. It's unbelievable that they've released two vicious mad dog killers upon the community. The vicious mad dog killers indeed kill again. And who's held responsible? No one. No one in the Prince George's County government will be held responsible, and there's a better than 50% chance that these three murderers won't be held responsible in the big picture. And again, it undermines any sense of justice we might have been holding out any hope for, and I would have to conclude that the time for holding out any hope for justice from any governing official in America, that time has long passed. View. I'm your host, Doug McBurney, just trying to navigate the torrential flood of bloodshed and murder that is the news this past week. I've got a story here from the Domestic Tranquility File. The New York Post reports that John DeRuba, he is an on-and-off lover of disgraced police officer Valerie Cincinelli, a married mom of two, who is behind bars right now in Brooklyn because the federal authorities say that she plotted with her boyfriend, John DeRuba. Did I mention she was a married mom of two? But she was plotting with her boyfriend, you see, her boyfriend, to kill Isaiah Carvalho, her estranged husband, who had sued her for divorce last year because she was cheating on him. And by the way, the two have a young son. So all these governing officials who released these MS-13 gang members, who released Johnny Walker Black, who released these two murderers from in Colorado. It's a pandemic that's nationwide. All these governing officials, they've also decriminalized adultery, which leads to more death and bloodshed than any terrorists. Now, this one, this murder didn't happen only because the police happened to intervene. But she was plotting to kill not only her husband, but she, the feds say she had a second target, her boyfriend's 15-year-old daughter with whom she did not get along. So when the boyfriend found out she wanted to kill his daughter as well, he wore a wire. Yeah, that was a bridge too far. Now, the killing of the husband, he was willing to go along with that, apparently. But when he found out that his maniac girlfriend, who was married, by the way, wanted to kill his daughter, he wore a wire, and there is audio tape evidence, ample audio tape evidence that this woman, what's her name? Should I even say her name again? No. Valerie whatever, is guilty as sin. There's ample audio evidence that she is guilty as sin. Anyway, in the end, neither the girl nor the estranged husband were harmed, says the New York Post. I would disagree with that. They were harmed. They had someone plotting to murder them. That harms your psyche for life. And this woman who plotted to kill them, she'll get out of jail someday. If she goes, she'll get out of jail someday. The guy who wore a wire, who was actively plotting a murder before he changed his mind, He'll never go to jail. So here's two people who were plotting to kill two other people, and they're all going to end up back in the same community together at some point in the not-too-distant future would be my prediction. And so the level of tension and angst and social tension clicks up another notch in that community as murderers and their potential victims, attempted murderers are allowed to roam free in the streets, which will happen. and it's just unfortunate. From there, we go to Apple CEO Tim Cook in the Queering of America file. Tim Cook, a homo pervert, who also happens to be the CEO of a famous company, delivered the commencement speech for the 2019 graduate of Tulane University in New Orleans. Wasn't Tulane founded by Christians?
Harvard
was founded as a Christian school, and they've had several homo perverts deliver there. But here we've got an open pervert delivering this. It's just unbelievable. Tulane president Mike Fitz touted getting the CEO, Tim Cook. He called Mr. Cook. He says, Mr. Cook, quote, represents the kind of success we hope all of our graduates can attain. Maybe not the sodomy, but maybe, you know, unquote. Well, he didn't quite say it that way. He made no reference to the sodomy because you're not allowed to refer to that when you talk about Tim Cook, unless you're on the Weekly Worldview. Then you can mention it. But Tim Cook opened up his commencement speech with this sentence, quote, in some important ways, my generation has failed you, unquote, said Tim Cook. Yeah, by becoming a flaming pervert, you decided to go sodomize other men and just pleasure yourself. You have failed us, Mr. Cook. You have failed the younger generation. Tim Cook went on to say, quote, you don't need to look far to find an example of that failure, unquote. Everyone was already looking at him, so they didn't have to look very far. But he wasn't talking about himself. He was talking, of course, about climate change and the failure of his generation to address climate change, to which some of the students might have said, well, yeah, but you were like going to gay nightclubs and maybe you should have been fighting global warming when you were doing all that, Tim. But he did admit he failed them, at least on the climate change front. listen to what Tim Cook actually said. In the coastal communities right here in Louisiana, people are already making plans to leave home and head for higher ground. Unquote. Really? I hadn't heard that, Tim. I mean, I think that some college professors and deluded homosexual CEOs have asserted that upon occasion, but I really don't know of people making plans to pack up and head for higher ground due to climate change. But who knows, Tim? If you and the other captains of industry and leaders of our political and religious culture, with climate change having now assumed the stature of a religion, perhaps people will start packing up and heading for higher ground because they're actually taking you seriously, which I do not understand. Let's see. What else do we have from the wisdom of Tim Cook? He says, we forget sometimes that our pre-existing beliefs have their own force of gravity. Certain algorithms pull towards you things that you already know, believe, and like, and they push away everything else. Push back. It shouldn't be this way. Unquote. So that is Tim Cook's backhanded attack on Christianity and the tradition of Christian morality that we all know, right? He says our pre-existing beliefs have their own force of gravity. So he acts like he's talking about algorithms, but what he's talking about is Christianity and its condemnation of his perverted lifestyle. And that's what he wants people to push back. And don't push away everything else. Be like me. I started to not push away like going to the gay bar instead of taking my family to the baseball game. All right. Get out of here, Tim Cook. Yes, I can't take any more of that. A new survey. We've got, we always love a new survey, right? I could care less about a new survey, but this new survey does give you some information that is valuable and something that you should know. Gallup reports that 43% They first report on a 1942 survey that found that 40% of Americans describe socialism as a bad thing. 25% said it was a good thing, and 34% said they had no opinion. 25% said it's a good thing. That's not surprising in 1940. When was it? 1942. FDR was in an office. America was being socialized. But 34% had no opinion. That did not portend well for the future of America. Well, the latest survey. Well, no, let's not go to the latest survey. But let's. This is from Gallup.com, by the way. They say previous research shows that Americans' definition of socialism has changed over the years, with nearly one in four now associating socialism with social equality, and only 17% associating it with its actual definition, the government having control over the means of production. That's actually what socialism is. But people don't even know that anymore. So they don't even know what they're being asked about. They think they're being asked about social justice and that every black boy and girl can go to college, right? And every Latino can get a good paying job. That's what they think it's all. That's what they think socialism is. Anyway, the latest survey is 43% believe that socialism is a good thing, and a majority of Democrats, 57% of Democrats, think socialism is a good thing. Not surprising. I mean, you already had 54% of the country back in 1942 who either thought it was good or didn't know. So we were bound to end up here where we are today, and I think if something doesn't change significantly, we are bound to end up wherever it is Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Fernandez or Chibanez, Cortez, yeah, wherever they want to take us. That's where we're going to go. Maybe not in this election cycle. But probably in my children's lifetime, we will lose the free market completely. And it will be the Christians who lost it, because it's the Christians who gave it to us. So never before in human history had a free market been able to survive like it and thrive as it is, as it has in the world in the past few hundred years since the Enlightenment. It never happened before, ever. And it's been a relatively short time, and we're going to blow it, and it's very, very sad. All right. Now, we go from Tim Cook and people running for higher ground and basically half the country embracing socialism, even though they don't even know what it is. We go from there to the co-founder of Greenpeace. Listen to this. Now, this is interesting. This is from the Real Science File. Yes, the Real Science File. Greenpeace co-founder Patrick Moore testified before Congress last week, and he said that all this talk of the sixth great extinction that we've been covering here on The Worldview, the stuff that NPR, ABC, NBC, CNN, MSNBC, LSMFT, LSD, THC, they all use it to scare the children, this great extinction that's coming upon us. He says this is the co-founder of Greenpeace. He says there is no evidence to support these doomsday predictions whatsoever. And this guy is no right-wing conservative. This is a Greenpeace guy. This guy used to ride the speedboats out there chasing after the whale hunters. Anyway, he told this Democrat-led House committee that the Unglobal Assessment Report from the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services also, excuse me, that's just too many words. I can't get it. Also known as IPBES. IPBES is what we... He says that report is merely a front for a radical political, social, and economic transformation of our entire civilization. I think this guy might be listening to the show. I think I said pretty much the exact same thing just a few weeks ago. I can't believe I'm agreeing with the co-founder of Greenpeace. Anyway, he says this is all a manufactured climate crisis. He says the specter of a mass extinction is a fear tactic to scare the public into compliance. And he says that IPBES itself is an existential threat to sensible policy on biodiversity and conservation. Well, the IPBES report, the worst acronym in the history of acronyms. You can't have a B and a P. It just doesn't work. Figure out some other letters. You're allowed to leave some letters out when they don't work. Don't you people even know how to make an acronym anymore? The IPBES report was released early this month, widely covered in the mainstream media and here in the alternative media, here at the Weekly Worldview, where we debunked the whole thing, or at least we asserted it was bunk. There was no need to debunk it. It was so obviously bunk, it needed no debunking. The bunk had already been debunkified right here on the Weekly Worldview. The IPBES, by the way, if you remember, they claim there are 8 million species. But actual scientists say there are only 1.8 million species that have been identified and named. Thus, the IPBES believes there are 6.2 million unidentified and unnamed species. Therefore, 1 million of the unknown species could go extinct overnight and we would not notice because we would not have known they had existed. But we're supposed to be scared anyways, children. Be terrified and feel guilty that you are about to kill a million species that we didn't even know existed. We didn't even get to know them first, and we're already destroying them. So horrible. The former Greenpeace, not former, the co-founder, Patrick Moore, says this is highly unprofessional. No, I'm sorry. ClimateDepot.com, where I got the story, they say this assertion about these 6.2 million unidentified and unnamed species, they say it's highly unprofessional. Scientists should not and cannot predict estimates of endangered species or species extinction based on millions of undocumented species. Well, yeah, that's obvious. Not only is it, it's more than unprofessional, though. Because unprofessional means that you might be cheating for money or to be famous or to get your paper published. That's unprofessional. This is an outright lie to try to scare a generation of children into either embracing, running into the arms of socialism, or perhaps feeling so guilty that they end up considering suicide. That's far beyond unprofessional. That's diabolical. And you are one with the Worldview, and I'm your host, Doug McBurney. So when I was in New York City during the week, this past week, the one thing I was not worried about was hail. Now, I don't know if you people can hear the rain. It's pelting the exhaust vent here at the Worldview compound deep here in the ringing down through the boiler room here. And so this is my annual fear of hail is now ratcheting up. Last night, watching the local weather, they said tomorrow is going to be a beautiful day. It's going to be sunny and nice. It's going to be near 80 degrees. And then in the afternoon, there could be 1 to 2 inch hail and tornadoes. And so I had dreams last night about hailstones punching holes through the roof, coming into the bedroom. I have an irrational fear of hail and tornadoes. And I know that the chance of being killed by hail or tornadoes is extremely slim. I'm sure it's in the million to one type, right? So live in Colorado, your chances of being killed by hail or a tornado are extremely low, but there is a chance, see. If you go look at our PVC ranch fence, there's holes in it the size of tennis balls. So there is a chance, right? And here's the thing about living in Colorado. If you live in Colorado, your chances of being governed by child-killing radical homosexual socialists is 100%. 100% on that. And so why would you want to put up with even any percentage of any chance of anything else bad happening, like being killed by hail or having your house thrown into a neighboring county by a tornado? It's just, I'm just pondering that. That's all. I just want to throw that out there. One thing they don't have in New York City, it's crowded there. You know what the difference between the buses in New York City and in Denver are? Or you know what the difference is? So all the buses in Denver are empty. The buses in New York, I had two bags trying to get from LaGuardia to Bergen County, New Jersey. I have to get on the bus. I have two bags. I have a carry-on. I have my computer bag. I put them in a seat next to me like a civilized human, thinking I'm in Colorado. Nobody else is going to get on this bus. That bus ended up with people hanging off the front door, practically. I had to put both bags between my legs before an enormous 450-pound woman pressed me up against the side of the bus for the 40-minute ride out to Bergen County. And I had visions in my head of all the empty buses in Denver and how much I would rather be commuting. But I wasn't. But anyway, the people there were fabulous. Even the 450-pound woman, she was very gracious about the whole thing.
I know the difference.
The trains? What's the difference with the trains?
Oh,
in New York, the trains are always on time. Oh, yes, indeed. Very cutting criticism of our governing officials here in Colorado. All right. What are we doing now? Now we're going to go to another story here from the Real Science File. This is just mind-boggling. Prepare to have your mind boggled by the creative genius of the living God who made all this. So scientists, let's see, at the University of Edinburgh, have published a study in the journal Nature Communications, and they say that cells in the body, biological cells are wired like computer chips to direct signals that instruct how they function. Yes. Unlike a fixed circuit board, however, cells can rapidly rewire their communication networks to change their behavior. This discovery, they say, turns our understanding of how information spreads around a cell on its head. That's right. The closer we look at the biological cell, the closer we look at biology in general, the more wildly sophisticated and incredible and amazing we find it to be. You see, signals in the past, scientists thought, signals were transmitted in waves, and the frequency of the waves was the crucial part of the message. But the researchers at Edinburgh found that information is actually carried across a web of guide wires that transmit signals across tiny nanoscale distances and transmit information. Yeah, information. Just like a computer. And this basically supports what I've been hearing from my friends at Real Science Radio for the past, 15 years, that biology is not only a physical science, but it's an information science. And in fact, the more we look, the more we realize that it's more of an information science than it is a physical science. Now, the research indicates that this movement of charged molecules transmits information like a computer. And when these signals reach the nucleus of a cell, they instruct minute changes in the structure that release specific genes so that they can be expressed. And these changes in gene expression further alter the behavior of the cell. Researchers say that understanding the code that controls this wiring system could help us understand diseases and could open up new treatment opportunities. Did you hear that? They called it a code. Do you know what a code is? A code is a system of symbolic logic. How is it that symbolic logic could arise in a purely physical universe with no spiritual, with nothing, with not? How could that be? How can Mr. Darwin explain this, or the neo-Darwinists, or any of that? How can they explain any of this? Well, the scientists used high-powered microscopes, and they were able to observe the wiring network with the help of computing techniques. And they say this is an example of quantum biology, a field that uses quantum mechanics and theoretical chemistry to solve biological problems. Again, published in the Nature in Nature Communications. Just fascinating, fascinating stuff. We are going to find within our own bodies, we're going to find the ability to cure every disease and heal every injury short of loss of a limb. And maybe even that. We're going to find it all in there. It's in there. It's just really small. And we're looking more and more closely. And like I say, if we can keep civilization from falling into the hands of the madmen or the child-killing radical homosexual socialists, and we're still able to do science that's not politicized, we will make all these discoveries. Well, wait a minute. We're already being governed by child-killing radical homosexual socialists. The civilization has already fallen into their hands. You know what, though? Science, real science, when done properly, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter the politicization. Can I even say that? It doesn't really matter. It doesn't hold back actual scientists. They make discoveries despite the political environment. They make these discoveries despite all that. Anyway, it's exciting to see. One more from the Real Science file. The Food and Drug Administration last week approved the first gene therapy for a type of spinal muscular atrophy. This new drug is known as Zolgensma. It's a gene therapy that treats children under 2 years of age with spinal muscular atrophy. It's an inherited neuromuscular disease that causes a progressive loss of muscle function. A lot of these kids, by the age of two, they either die or they have to rely on permanent breathing support to live. The disease is caused by a defect in a gene that makes SMN. Now, they call it a defect. You know, evolutionists, they say that we evolve based on mutation of genes. Well, this is what actually happens when there's a mutation in a gene. Mutations are generally not beneficial. They're called a defect. And this particular defect causes a defect in the gene SMN, the gene that makes SMN, a protein necessary for the survival of motor neurons. So listen to this. Zolgensma uses a re-engineered virus to deliver a functional copy of the defective gene so that SMN protein can be produced. So this is amazing. You know, the first time I believe, and I could be wrong about this, the first time I ever heard of the idea of a virus being able to beneficially change a gene was from my friends on Real Science Radio, Bob Enyart and Fred Williams, where they had a talk about why are there viruses? Viruses are bad, right? Well, they talked about scientists who posited theories and ideas that viruses may have initially had a beneficial function. Viruses may have had a beneficial function in helping to repair the breakdown of the genome. Because our Father, the living God who created the universe, knew that there would be a certain level of degeneration in the genome as history progressed. But viruses were here to fix those. But that was before the fall of man and before the whole universe broke and viruses became broken and bad. But viruses initially very well may have had a beneficial function. And now that we've re-engineered this, by the way, this virus didn't just evolve this ability to repair this gene. It had to be engineered in a laboratory. But anyway, this supports the ideas that I heard first made public, at least to the broader scientific community and the broader lay community in general, just the average Joe out there like me, that I first heard on Real Science Radio, which is why you folks should tune in. Check it out. If you download this podcast, download Real Science Radio because you'll be ahead of the curve. Anyway, let's see here. Oh, the story, by the way, is from a website called Stat News, and most of this story is actually bemoaning the cost of this drug. So this drug is going to cost, if your child has spinal muscular atrophy and you want your child to have this drug, it's going to cost approximately, hold on here, $2.125 million. $2.125 $1 million is what the drug will cost. $425,000 a year for 5 years is the estimate. Mm-hmm. And that's what most of this article is talking about, this evil, horrible drug company that's going to charge $2 million, basically. But for me, to save my child's life, $2 million, I will go into indentured servitude. I will take a job sweeping the laboratory at the drug company for me and the next three generations, if that's what it takes, to save my child's life. So yes, $2 million is a lot of money for a drug. Don't get me wrong. But who's going to fund the research that makes these incredible breakthroughs? Do you think that they just stumbled across this in a lab by accident? Someone knocked over a beaker and suddenly they had this virus? No. This took billions of dollars. And someone has to pay for that. And anyway, it is expensive. But the article concludes by saying, hey, there's also competition. There's another drug that was approved in 2016. Spinraza, sold by Biogen. It's already been used to treat other both severe and milder forms of SMA, spinal muscular atrophy. That drug cost $750,000 for the first year and then $375,000 a year for life. They sold about $1.7 billion worth of that drug last year. Zolgensma may be more convenient. And then there's other competition. Roche, is developing a daily pill for SMA called Risdiplam that could reach the market by 2020. So here's the thing. The prices of these drugs will come down as these drug companies pay off the R&D, the development costs. These drugs, eventually these drugs will be cheap. Eventually. But yes, it's expensive, but it's amazing to consider the possibility that we're on the verge of breakthroughs in curing so many diseases, so many illnesses, and so many things that have devastated communities and families for millennia. And here we stand, and it's all based on seeking the truth, you see. Those who say that there's no such thing as truth have never done science. They've never done biology research. They've never tried to create a drug. Because that when you try to create a drug that effectively treats a disease, you must seek the truth. And even if you're an atheist and you don't believe in God and you're not sure if there's anything that's true, on a daily basis in your daily life, you pursue the truth. And when you find the truth can set you free. And it can cure diseases. And it can free the minds of the billions, of the masses, the truth. The truth will set us free. All right, now, speaking of the truth, I remember when Barack Obama ended NASA's active space program and conservatives were up in arms, saying that Barack Obama was just un-American. But I think that we're going to find that privatizing space exploration and science and work in outer space, we're going to find that privatizing all of that was a transformative event. And even if it was stumbled into backwards for the wrong reasons by Barack Obama, we will find that is a transformative event that will change everything. Elon Musk's SpaceX has Starlink going on. They want to provide reliable internet, ideally throughout the whole world, says Elon Musk. He hopes to deploy as many as 12,000 satellites to give internet to the whole world. Listen to this. Right now, there are only about 5,000 satellites in orbit in total. And only about 2,000 of those actually still function. And private companies, because Elon Musk's not the only guy doing this, there are others. Private companies could put tens of thousands of satellites into orbit just in the next decade. And it could be that within just a few years, commercial company satellites will outnumber every satellite ever put up into space ever by all the governments of the world. And I think that's just exciting. The reporters at The Atlantic say that it is rather astonishing, and indeed it is. But for all of you children who are afraid of destroying the planet and ready to embrace socialism, just remember that government bureaucracies are the ultimate expression of socialism. And they've managed to put 5,000 satellites in orbit, and the free market is going to eclipse that quite possibly within the next 3 to 5 years. Quite possibly. And so just an example of how the free market guided by a pursuit of the truth. Trust me, when you try to put a satellite into orbit, you cannot do it without pursuing the truth and doing things precisely, correctly, accurately, right, and true. That's what has to happen for a satellite to achieve orbit and then to stay in orbit and then to function. There's a billion truths that must be realized in order to do that. And so there is truth, boys and girls. And it's right there in front of your face because the glory of our Creator is clearly seen and understood by the things that He made. It's undeniable. And we celebrate it here at the Weekly Worldview, and we'll do it again next week. Yes. For now, I want to thank my friends at KGOV.com, at RealScienceRadio.com, and of course, at AmericanRightToLife.com. And then there's my other brother, Daryl, who makes it all happen. Here in the Weekly Worldview studios, should the Lord tarry, we'll return next week. And until then, may the grace of God be with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.